morning and welcome to our Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air on 104.6 Planet FM. My name is Harriet, I'm an alcoholic and will be chairing our meeting this morning. Please welcome our speakers today, Amy, Neil and Scott, who will be sharing their experience, strength and hope with you all. Would you all like to help me open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer?
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
This is the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I would like to ask Amy if she would care to share her experience, strength, and hope with us.
Thanks, Harriet. Hi, I'm Amy. I'm an alcoholic. And today I just thought I'd share some of the early part of my story in case it resonates with any of you listening. So I knew I was an alcoholic a long time before I came into AA. A lot of my early drinking was fun, and somewhere in my 30s I started hiding drinking and then carrying it with me, and I sort of obviously was pretty terrified at the thought of what that meant, but I just decided to myself that that was just my secret and part of my life and carried on like that for quite a while, really. Somewhere along the way, I was getting more and more terrified with how much I was drinking, and I decided I was going to detox myself by going from the numerous sort of bottles of wine I was drinking per day and get like less and less each day with the thought of being sober in a month and then being able to continue a sober life. That obviously didn't work. And part-time during this journey, I remember calling my GP in tears on like a Tuesday morning and just saying I was terrified about what my body would do if I stopped drinking and could he help me. He didn't know that I had a problem with alcohol until that phone call. And he booked me into a medical detox, which probably saved my life. I went along for a week at the medical detox, and it was, I thought it was going to be the hardest part of the journey, was the easiest. I remember meeting the people there and feeling really safe that these doctors and nurses were going to make sure that we didn't have a stroke or a heart attack while we were detoxing, and it felt like a really safe sort of unit, but I had no idea the severity really of what this disease is and how thin the ice was that we were walking on. There was one girl there who we looked at like a team leader. She'd been in detox before. She was funny and confident, and we sort of followed her lead, really. A year to the week after I left that detox, she was found dead in her driveway with her bottle of vodka. And I don't know what happened to the rest of the people that were in that week with me. I see very few of them in the rooms. So the real journey starts once you leave the detox, or it did for me. I had 6 weeks of white-knuckling it after I left that detox, staying away from alcohol, doing everything that I could, and then I relapsed, and that's when really the real journey started. My GP was really open-minded. He was an American. He was very into the AA program, and he really sort of pushed me through the doors of AA. And like a lot of people, I remember walking in and just feeling the intense shame and disbelief that my drinking had come to this. I had all the stereotypes that most people have about AA. I had no idea and certainly no belief that I'd find any connections with the people in the rooms or that I'd get anything out of it. I thought we would all just sit around and share war stories and miss drinking together. Well, I'd really, you know, obviously I had no idea. And I sort of bucked and went against the program for a number of years, really. I was sort of under the duress of my family to go. My mother would drive me to meetings and do Sudoku in her car and sort of hustle me into the car after the meeting. And it was hell. I wasn't really listening to people. I was planning how I was going to get my next drink and my very constricted life of everyone sort of micromanaging me. And I wasn't listening or opening myself to anything that AA has to offer. And that went on for a few years, really. And it was, yeah, I'd get to a certain point of sobriety and then I'd have another relapse. I had a sponsor. I was working the steps, but it was still a very shaky start for me. There's a lot of people that come into AA and manage to stop drinking from their first meeting, and that's great, but that certainly wasn't my story. So one thing I did do, though, is I kept going to meetings. I went to some drunk. I went to the bottle shop after some. I was filled with shame, and I just couldn't believe it would work. But I just kept going, and somewhere along the way, I actually started to really admire and respect the people in the rooms, and I started to really listen to what they had to say. And that's, I don't know, when the miracle started to happen, people sharing these stories that completely resonated with my own, feeling the safety in the rooms to share honestly and completely and then walk out and be able to have a beautiful life from what the rooms gave me. And my real journey started. It still wasn't easy. I still had relapses. I've been in the rooms 8 years and I'm 2.5 years sober. But I wouldn't change any of that journey. It got me to where I am today, and I'm very grateful for every part of it. I think the surrendering, which they suggest in step one of AA, is one of the hardest things that most alcoholics have to do. It certainly was for me. So much pride and ego and disbelief that this was happening to me got in the way of a quicker recovery. But I'm very grateful for where it's all led me. So if you're new and you're struggling, AA's rooms are definitely an amazing place to enter. Listening to other people's stories is what finally saved me. Nature became my higher power, and I saw the world through completely different eyes. And I'm so grateful for every part of the journey, and everything and everyone that I've met along the way. It's a wonderful support, and it's there for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Amy. Neil, would you care to share, please?
Sure. Hi, I'm Neil. I'm an alcoholic. I always drunk aggressively. I remember my first drink was actually my first try at a drink was at some party when I was 14 or 15 years old, and I kept bugging the older kids to give me a beer, and they tricked me and they put water into a beer can and gave it to me, and I thought it was beer, and they kept asking me how it was. So from a young age, I just wanted a drink. I wanted to be cool. I wanted to be accepted. I wanted people to like me, and I thought that drinking and drugs was, you know, my way to get there, to be accepted. Then my first real drink was a whole glass of like terribly cheap vodka, and I just sculled it and blacked out and had a ball. I mean, the bits that I remember, it was fun ish you know, that was whatever, 16, 17. And that was like that. Those two moments, I guess, if I think about it, kind of somewhat a good overall picture of my attitude towards drinking. It was always about being cool or being accepted, you know, being one of us, us being, you know, the in crowd. And then the other side was just not drinking normally. I was never sipping anything. It was just always with a goal to, you know, just have a lot and have a lot of fun. And funnily enough, my drinking was a lot of fun. Went heaps at parties,
like to travel the world, you know, drunk in all every single city, town, corner that I could find. But yeah, it was always just my relationship. For me, at least, my relationship was always very highly like, just wanted more. I always wanted more. Next drink, next drug, next high, next party, next girl, next whatever it was, next friend, next song. Just more. There was never enough. One beer was not enough, and you know, infinity was too much. And so my life just kept going along that path, just kept slowly drinking more and more. And I don't know when it happened, but one day, there was a day, and I'll never know what day that was. I crossed the line from enjoying the drink and using it as like an enhancement to socializing or partying or hanging out or relaxing. And I crossed the line one day when, and it was no longer that, it was medication. It was to soothe this hole in my soul. And I didn't know why that hole was there. And actually, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really, to me, what I've been taught, it doesn't matter why that hole is there. I had a pretty relatively normal upbringing. You know, I hear lots of really difficult, sad stories in the program of people who've had very, very challenging upbringings. And for me, that hasn't been the case. It wasn't perfect, but it certainly was not sort of by definition traumatic. But still, I have this hole in my soul, and I constantly tried to medicate it. And so, yeah, I crossed the line one day. And, you know, even when I say those words, I crossed the line, the thing I think about is me going down the stairs of my flat and walking into my kitchen, no matter what time of day, and this is, you know, normally the first thing in the morning, to go get, quote-unquote, a coffee. And my eyes would just go up towards that shelf at the top where all the booze was, the wine, the spirits. And they say it's a progressive disease. Certainly was for me. You know, it's kept getting worse and worse, and I would always forget all the bad things that happened and that I would do when I was drinking. And you know, I would put on my rose tinted glasses and pretend my life was okay. I worked hard. I deserved to drink. It was her fault that I was drinking. It was the stress of the job. It was, I'm in the city. This is what people do here. And they're all excuses to justify my drinking. And then, yeah, it just kept getting worse and worse. And then one day, I lost my job. Yeah, I got into a new industry, was doing very, very well there. They'd offered me an extremely, like, a great position. And then I celebrated that night when I was offered the role with the rest of the team, and it didn't go so well, and I got fired. So I still remember when I flew back home being in a taxi back to my flat and thinking, something's got to change. The gift of desperation finally was given to me. And so I entered into the program for the first time, or at least started through some sort of rehab clinic. And then, yeah, like many of us, I think, then, you know, I was kind of in and out, hadn't had enough pain, hadn't had enough rock bottom. So I went out a few other times and kept kind of, and I love this saying now when I look back to describe how it was, is that I found rock bottom, and it turns out rock bottom has a basement. Mm-hmm. And so you know, I tried, even after I'd entered into the program to start with, I tried everything, right? Only drink beer, only drink wine, only drink in the weekend, only drink with friends, only drink at home, only drink when you're doing other drugs. Don't drink at all, but just have one with dinner. You know, every single management style I could apply, I tried, and they all ended up in the same, eventually, like they might work for a week, a month, maybe even a little longer, but eventually it all ended up in absolute devastation. And yeah, so this disease destroyed everything around me, including me, my pride, my self-worth, my family, people who loved me, destroyed it all. This disease destroys everything around me. It did for me, just completely obliterated it. But then I was told that if I go to meetings, if I get a sponsor, if I work the steps, and if I'm honest, that I can have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And it happened. It just sounds incredible. It sounds ridiculous. It sounds like hokum, but it's exactly what happened. Slowly, day by day, I just tried to do what I was told by my sponsor, which was go to meetings, work the steps, just do whatever he said, frankly, just do whatever he said. And that included go to meetings. And lo and behold, the wreckage of my past was slowly, slowly cleared. And I'm still going through that every day, and I will till the end of my time, but it's a beautiful journey. And I was told this, they said, Neil, you don't believe that by doing these 12 steps that you can have a life beyond your wildest dreams. Why would you? It sounds like black magic. It sounds ridiculous. You need to have a little bit of faith, and that's what I'm here for. So, yeah, what I was told, get a sponsor, go to meetings, and just do what the sponsor tells you, and that will lead you to a life beyond your wildest dreams. And that certainly, certainly has been true for me. I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Neil. Scott, would you like to share?
Hi, I am Scott, and I am an alcoholic. I think it took me quite some time to say that and actually understand it and mean it. I guess for a long time, I've never really sort of recognized myself as being an alcoholic. I just had some behaviors and bad habits that didn't serve me well in life. But I guess that's kind of been the crux of my life, really, just unwilling to accept things that were truths. And I guess that's kind of been, to a large degree, a reason why I've become an alcoholic. My foray into alcoholism, I suppose, started very early. Like my dad, he would like Spates Gold. That was his drink. And, we would entertain at our houses on the odd occasion, and Dad would leave his beers around, and Scott would go, "Oh, that looks good. Dad's having that, so, you know, I should have a look at that as well." And this was at 5 years old. I grabbed one of those cans and sculled it like he did. Because, I guess it was monkey see, monkey do, which followed me throwing that up. But, I guess once I tasted that, and like it almost had an instant effect on me, weirdly enough, even with that small amount, it was kind of wild. And then the other side of that was my mum. She wasn't really a drinker per se, not like my dad was, but she smoked cigarettes, and I liked the smell of that already when I was, a little kid. I was like, "Mum's smoking cigarettes, that looks cool. I think I should probably do that as well." So I started pinching Mum's cigarettes and then feeding them out to my friends. And they're like, we were cool. And, I grew up in the 80s in a small town, small city, Dunedin, and in a little town south of it called Mosgiel. And, there wasn't a great deal to do back in those days, but, I think probably for me, what I first discovered was my lack of boundaries. My dad was working a lot, my mum was working a lot, so, after school there was a lot of time for me to just go and do whatever I want, and not really have any boundaries. I was like, they'll just be home by whatever time, and, we would just go and have leverage on that and just go out and be wicked little children, and I did some things in my childhood, which they call a wicked childhood, and I set bloody sides of motorways on fire, and we destroyed an amusement park, and, did all these really crazy things, really. And the interesting part is we always got away with it. It was never, I don't know how that really happened, but my childhood, the lack of boundaries was probably a big thing for me. And as a result, I would always seek to, I needed to be entertained, I suppose you could say. So we sought out ways to entertain ourselves. And all my friends seemed to have parents who had good alcohol cabinets. So, one had wine, one had the Caruba, and It was an interesting night at 12 years old, having Karuba, a big bottle of that, and we were sculling it because we thought we were awesome, listening to Inner Kamuzi, and, you know, just, man, we thought we were gangster, I suppose, eh? I don't know. But, yeah, I guess at that point in time, I had my first real sort of throwing up of the alcohol, and my first real sort of, I guess, pissed experience, really, at 12 years old. And it was awful. The next day I felt awful. But seemingly that wasn't really sort of anything that stopped me going out to try more. Like, you know, the next day my mates were like, oh, I've got some wine, should we go and do that? And we'll go down to the park and we'll go and smoke some ciggies. So, you know, we did that. And, yeah, I guess that's where it all sort of started for me. It was just an escalation over time, really. And then coming into my earlier sort of teen years, it became kind of a regular thing. Like the weekends, we would always be drinking. If there was a party on, you know, we would go out and, you know, the aim was to get as blotto as you possibly could, really. And I never really, I discovered that I never really liked the actual taste of alcohol, maybe like the sugary ones, but I guess it was kind of, yeah, I just drank for the effect. And I liked the effect, I liked to be out of it, because I don't know what it was, but whether I just wasn't really encouraged enough as a child, or, you know, mum didn't love me enough, or I don't really know what it was, but I just felt like a square peg in a round hole in any sort of social situation. I just felt like I had, I just felt like I just couldn't communicate with people in a way that other people seemed to be able to do, and it was the alcohol that filled that hole for me, and I thought, oh, this is great, you know, I found something that sorts that problem out. So yeah, why wouldn't I use that and all the time, like I did. Then moving on to sort of like earlier sort of early to late teens, you know, I discovered other substances a little bit, but still it was alcohol that I would come back to. And then by age 18, I had my first DIC, which I should have had heaps more of them, but, you know, I just happened to get caught on that day where I entered into a street where I couldn't get out of or turn around. And, you know, back in those days, you, like, do a U and you gap it. But, yeah, there was no choice in that matter, and I had to spend the night in the cells, which was not a great experience. And, you know, mum wasn't overly impressed with that either. but, you know, still I didn't learn from that experience. I would go out and the very next weekend we were doing the same thing and drinking and driving, because, you know, I guess that's just kind of what we did. We didn't really think of any sort of consequences. Yeah, so I guess then for me it was kind of just rinse and repeat for another 10 years of doing that, and just escalating things every single weekend, really. And then I discovered other substances again, which took me into places of like dance parties and so forth. And then I was really sort of cracking into it then, and, you know, spending 2 or 3 days after that just hungover and really like just really sick. So yeah, I guess that sort of followed me right through my 20s, 30s. I was still working and, you know, had a career at this point, but you know, really, if I'm honest, like my whole operation of life was to get up and you use basically drugs or alcohol. That was my motivation, really, and everything else became second or third or even further down the line. And, you know, they say, you know, alcohol is a progressive disease, and for me it certainly was. Like, you know, through the years it's got worse and worse and worse for me, and then, you know, consequences of, you know, finally caught up on me. And I could no longer live like Peter Pan and have no consequences for my action and take no responsibility for anything. So, yeah, I think probably in 2016 I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, probably 5% willing, 95% really to get people off my back. But I probably knew I was a bit buggered by then, but I just wasn't willing to admit it, and had no acceptance around that. And I guess that's been the key for it the whole way along, no acceptance. But I didn't really know what acceptance was, really. I was just so, I don't know, shackled to addiction, I suppose. That's what I like to call it. But, I've had to eat humble pie for a long time. But, you know, I guess for me, what got me into the rooms was desperation, I suppose, a little bit. And I've been flirting with the idea of sobriety for 10 years now. And I've just recently got my one-year tag, which I'm super, super proud of myself for that moment. I never thought it was actually possible. I just thought, oh, this is my lot. I'm just going to be an alcoholic for the rest of my life and maybe die early and be done with it. But, you know, I've got some hope now, and I've understood that I can live 12 months without drinking, which, yeah, like I said, I didn't think that was actually possible. But now that I know that it is, you know, it gives me hope that I can carry on and move on with my life in a much more positive manner. But, you know, I'm eternally grateful to the rooms for showing me the way. I haven't been a perfect student, but, you know, that's okay too. You know, it's progress, not perfection, as it's said. And I'm certainly doing things, you know, one day at a time. It's not easy. My mind wants to take me out all the time, but I just have to understand that my mind wants to lie to me, and those are old beliefs, which, you know, I need to challenge on a daily basis. But, you know, I can't do it alone. It's a wee program. If I have some belief in myself and continue to stay in the rooms and do the next right thing, I think I've got a good chance of having another 25 or 30 years of life that's joyful and a happy space. And I get to share it with some other people that are going on the same journey. So, yeah, I could talk all day, but, that's kind of me in a nutshell. I'm just really hopeful of the future, so hopefully you hear something in what I've said that resonates with you and then can help you. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That's all we have time for today. Thank you so much, Amy, Neil and Scott, for joining us in the studio today and for all of you listening. We're on air each Sunday, 10:45 a.m. here on 104.6 Planet FM. If you or anyone you know is in need of help from Alcoholics Anonymous, please either call 0800 AA Works, that's 0800-229-6757, or visit the AA website, www.aa.org.nz, www.aa.org.nz. Here you can find a raft of information, meetings in your local area, and literature that is available. Finally, you can find today's recording and others on the Planet FM website, www.planetaudio.org.nz, under the program name AA On Air. Finally, could you now join me in closing this meeting with the Serenity Prayer?
God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Connecting your community. Planet FM on planetaudio.org.nz.
Flooding can happen anytime. Are you prepared? Don't wait for the rain to start bucketing down. Clear those gutters, tie down loose items, and make an emergency plan to keep your whānau safe. A few minutes now can help save stress later. Stay ahead of the storm and keep your loved ones safe. Visit Auckland Emergency